like to welcome everybody here. Oh, I understand. Did you mention about the microphones?
I did.
Yeah, I'll just remind you again that when you're up there, you might need to speak really loudly. And if, by the same token, if you can't hear something that we're asking, let us know.
What?
So we have two cases to hear this afternoon. We'll take a very short break between the first and the second one. And I'll introduce the panel that we'll have for both cases. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand that the attorneys have checked in on the first case, and so I'll ask the clerk to call it.
The court will now call Tariq Al-Khayali versus the state of Texas. May it please the court, Ms. Helen Lytle to argue for the appellant, Ms. Victoria Oblong to argue for the state.
Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Heather Lytle, and it is my privilege to represent Tariq Al-Khayali. This is a murder case, as the court is aware. There were several points of error. I'm only going to spend my time on points of error 1 and 2, which deal with the jury charge, but I'm happy to answer questions about any other points of error that the court may have. From the outset, it's important that we remember this is not an indictment case. This is a jury charge case. So that said, the indictment is important because the specific question before this court is what specific jury charge did the indictment authorize? And it is our contention that the indictment, by omitting the element causing the death of an individual from paragraph number 2, effectively charged Mr. Al-Khayali first with murder, intentional and knowing murder, and second with something along the lines of aggravated assault. Removing the death of the individual, it changes the offense. It's not like another type of offense where if there is a defect of substance, it's still very clear what the offense is. In this case, if nobody died, then it's not a murder. It is an aggravated assault. So from the face of the indictment, Mr. Al-Khayali was charged with murder under section 19.02B1 and aggravated assault. Accordingly, the jury charge, or the trial court, was authorized to charge the jury to consider the evidence and to consider whether Mr. Al-Khayali was guilty or not guilty of intentional or knowing murder or aggravated assault. The jury was not authorized to consider any other alternative means of committing murder because the indictment did not charge Mr. Al-Khayali with an alternative means of committing murder. So, that said, because the jury was charged that the jury could convict Mr. Al-Khayali if they found from the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that he either intentionally or knowingly caused the death of Wissam Musa or that he intentionally committed an act clearly dangerous to human life, intending to cause serious bodily injury. And they came back with a conviction of murder. And as we know, when there are alternative means presented to a jury is not required to be unanimous as to which manner or means of the offense of murder. And so the jury was authorized to convict Mr. Al-Khayali of murder without a finding that he intentionally caused the death of Wissam Musa. And that kind of a conviction just can't stand. That's fundamentally defective. It's a fundamental error in the jury charge. And it violated his right, his 14th Amendment due process right, and his 6th Amendment right to a jury trial, to be convicted only if a jury finds him guilty of all elements of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. The state has argued that, you know, because this was a defect of substance, it doesn't change, and it wasn't objected to prior to trial, that it doesn't change the law of the case. I would argue that it does, and I think that's why we're here today. We need to discuss it and figure out how the court wants to handle it. I have not come across in my research another case that's similar. If the court has, I'm happy to be proven wrong on that.
Did you not cite to us Flores with Waco Court of Appeals, which appears to be similar in how you've discussed
it? Flores deals with just the error in the jury charge, which is absolutely on point. It's almost identical. I was speaking specifically to whether or not the jury could have even presented, whether or not the indictment authorized the jury charge to even have that paragraph in the first place.
Because the indictment didn't specifically say cause death.
Right.
With regard to the second alternative.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And right now, you're talking specifically about, I think it's on page 127. It's noted, I guess, if you want to call it the bait stamp. But it's 127 in the clerk's record. It's in the jury charge.
Mm-hmm.
It's the paragraph where there is this connection to the death of the individual based on the act that caused the serious bodily injury. But that's really the only time we ever see this anywhere.
Right.
Correct?
That's correct.
You don't see it in the indictment.
Right.
And you don't see this connection anywhere else in the charge but this particular paragraph.
That's correct.
And you're saying in this instance you haven't seen any cases that says when the indictment is lacking, but then it's thrown into the charge, how we deal with that.
Right. And that's why I presented it in the brief in two ways. I believe that there are two errors here. One, the jury charge should have never even included that second paragraph. And second, if the court finds that the flaw in the indictment wasn't enough to keep out an alternate means of committing murder from the jury charge, the fact that it allowed a conviction of murder without a finding of the death of the individual is in itself an egregious error also.
Let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. In the feds, I know that if you go from a charge to an indictment and you've now changed the language, mm-hmm. they call that a constructive amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Surely there's case law within state jurisprudence that deals with instances where the jury charge varies from the indictment in some form or fashion, because that has to happen pretty regularly.
There are. Honestly, I did not approach this issue from that angle because the indictment and the jury charge were not varied. They were identical.
Except for this paragraph.
No, they were the same. They were absolutely identically the same.
Sure, in the application paragraphs.
Yeah.
But you do have a situation with on page 127 mm-hmm. where there's some surplus language that's thrown in that's not in the indictment.
Right, and I honestly, Your Honor, I didn't catch that, and I'm happy to submit a letter brief to address what issue that may have, that kind of a variance. But as far as, if it were a constructive amendment, I know Article 2810 deals with amending indictments, just that an indictment can't be amended over the objection of a defendant if it charges a new offense. But again, we kind of deal with, that's not the case we have here, because we didn't have any kind of an objection from the defense about the language either in the indictment or the jury charge.
Yeah, and so, the problem with follow is the only entity that can indict an individual is a grand jury.
Right.
And that's constitutional. And so they lay out the theories in the indictment in their respective paragraphs. And here they laid out, basically, your argument is one type of murder and then something that's very similar to aggravated assault.
Right.
But ultimately he was charged with kind of a merger of those ideas.
Yeah.
Okay.
And because, the jury was not instructed that it needed to be unanimous between either of these theories, and if we looked at the state of the evidence in the state of the record, I don't think that this court can say clearly that at least some of the jurors would not have voted to convict under that second part of the application. Intent was clearly and hotly contested over the course of the crowd, that it came down to his intent, whether he intended to kill her or not.
If he had not been charged in the disjunctive,
mm-hmm.
then that might be a whole other analysis.
Absolutely.
But because he was charged in the disjunctive, just like he was indicted in the disjunctive,
mm-hmm.
that you're saying that.
Right. And that's where the Flores case is particularly instructive, because that case was obviously it was a little bit different circumstance, but it was nearly identical. That was the jury in that case actually convicted him of a lesser included, but in that application paragraph, it was disjunctive as well, and also omitted the death of the individual. And the 10th Court of Appeals found there that that was reversible error. Same, they did not have an objection in that case, so also under...
But it was they had to do egregious error mm-hmm. analysis. What was their reasoning as to why it was egregious?
They said that it was egregious error because it deprived him of a substantial right, which was the right to have a jury determine each element beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would argue that that same analysis applies here.
Is there any analysis of the fact that, and I don't know what the actual charge was in Flores, but what troubles me about this one is the jury is specifically instructed by the court to find him guilty if they find the second alternative.
Yeah.
It's not, it's a specific instruction. You are to find him guilty if mm-hmm. this is true. And then the cause of death is not in there. Was there any analysis in Flores with regard to that? And
the court did not go into its harm analysis very extensively, Justice Birdwell. They just noted the disjunctive. In that case, it was criminally negligent homicide, and there were two manners of means. And it was almost exactly the same. The first part of the application paragraph was correct, and then or... if you find, blah, blah, you know, the elements of criminally negligent homicide, but omitted the death of the individual. And the court found particularly noteworthy the disjunctive and said, so a jury could have found him guilty of criminally negligent homicide without finding the death of the individual because of that disjunctive. The harm analysis was not extensive in the opinion. They just simply said it deprived him of his substantial right and found reversible error in that way. So I could not have asked for a better case to compare this one to. It's nearly identical in that way. And so even if the issue with the indictment and whether or not it authorized that, you know, that second manner or means to even be there or not, even if the court finds that the indictment was sufficient to allow the jury charge to present a second that alternate manner of means of committing murder, because it omitted a requirement that Tarek Al-Khayali caused the death of Wassam Musa in that second application, I argued that that's fundamentally defective, and it deprived him of the same right in this case that Flores was deprived of in that case.
If we agree with you,
mm-hmm.
then do you think that we reverse and render, or do you think that we reverse and remand? I mean, there's if we reverse and remanded, he may get another trial, and things could potentially go different, I suppose.
Sure. Honestly, I would love to be able to say you should render. I would love to be able to say that. I'm not certain that the law would support that. I think in a jury charge case, I think the correct remedy is to reverse and remand for a new trial. It's not later in my other points of error, if you find and agree with me that the evidence is not sufficient, then certainly you could reverse and render an acquittal. But in that case, I think the answer is to reverse and remand for a new trial.
And this might go beyond the scope of our analysis, but you know, one of the concerns that the state would have is, would there be some kind of collateral estoppel issue? Would there be some kind of double jeopardy issue later on? And but the statute of limitations, there's no statute
right.
of limitations. They could re-indict, theoretically. But, okay.
Briefly, are there any other questions about the jury charge issue?
Well, I know you're not getting into other issues, but...
I certainly can, if
yeah,
you'd
sure.
like to.
I mean, is it your position that if we agree with you in your analysis, that we really don't even have to get into the idea of ineffective assistance of counsel, and that if it's egregious harm, it's egregious harm. We don't even have to talk about counsel's lack, of bringing to the court's attention.
Sure. I mean, I think that one issue, certainly the court would be within its ability and authority and discretion to reverse remand on that, and to not, the court could define that was dispositive and not need to reach the other issues. I don't relish the opportunity of calling a colleague ineffective. I know the attorney here. He's a good attorney.
Do we not have a problem that if we do that here, we effectively turn every charge error into ineffective assistance of counsel, because charge error is generally a matter of law, and they got the law right, and no attorney should have gotten the law wrong, and therefore every charge error ends up being ineffective assistance?
Well,
that's,
I think
that's my trouble about this particular argument.
Sure. Your Honor, I think that every legal error, you know, if it's a blatant charge error that is legally incorrect, which even the state would agree, omitting the death of the individual, that's a mistake.
But that gets us into, it was really, really bad.
It was
a really, really bad error, and then we have to start trying to define what constitutes a really, really bad error.
I think that's a case by case basis. There are some charge errors. I've argued cases where charge error has been found and ineffective assistance of counsel based on that charge error was not found.
Thank you, counsel. Your time's expired.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Victoria Oblon and I represent the state of Texas in this case. Before jumping into the points that we've been discussing today, I'd like to address the cumulative error point that was raised in appellant's reply brief, since the state has not had an opportunity to address that point. Cumulative error is an independent legal claim, which requires to be separately raised and argued accordingly. The Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure require appellants to raise their points of error, their issues, in their original brief. Likewise, the Rules of Appellate Procedure require a reply brief, to responding to issues in the appellee here at the state's brief. In Chambers v. State, which is the case cited by appellant in the reply brief addressing what may or may not be considered in a reply brief, the Court of Criminal Appeals explicitly held that new issues that are raised in the reply brief should not be considered as part of the appeal. The court there said that related matters can be addressed if they are raised in the reply brief. However, when giving examples of what is not a related matter, the court said that a completely independent issue on appeal is not related. It is simply that, a completely new issue, and that is what cumulative error is. Two other courts of appeals, Beaumont and San Antonio, have expressly declined to address cumulative error when it is raised exclusively in a reply brief. And this all makes sense because cumulative error, as its own independent claim, should not be dependent on what the state, in this case, concedes or does not concede. And I'd also like to clarify just a bit of a misstatement in the reply brief. The state did not outright concede 7 points of error in this brief. We did make a few concessions. There was a point of error that we assumed for argument's sake was error and addressed harm. And then in points of error 8, 9, and 10, those are the confrontation clause points of error, the vast majority of the claims or the statements that appellant raised as violations of the Confrontation Clause, the state did not concede error. We argued that they were not violations of the Confrontation Clause based on Dr. Freeze's testimony.
Counsel, let me just jump right into appellant's first issue. How does the state distinguish the Flores case, which seems to be fairly similar?
Yes, I would say in the Flores case, the And the error analysis, as Justice Birdwell was kind of questioning about, it was very, very limited. And in fact, the Dallas Court of Appeals in Garrow versus State, which is a 2002 case, they were rather harsh in their criticism of the Flores case, noting that they almost created a per se harm analysis. The Flores court, the Waco court, said that they were conducting an egregious harm analysis, but they did not go through the egregious harm factors. They did not look at the state of the record, the arguments of the party, the charge as a whole. They just kind of assumed that because of it was an omitted element, that it resulted in harm. And so if, when looking at this case, when you actually look at the factors as we are supposed to in a harm analysis, the record does not support that egregious harm analysis. Additionally, in Flores, the charge was, it was a criminally negligence is what they ultimately convicted on, and that was the erroneous charge that was in the disjunctive. And that was a lesser of the, I believe it was manslaughter, the defendant there was originally charged with. There were no other lessors in that case. In this case, when we're looking at the jury charge as a whole, as we're supposed to in the harm analysis, there were two additional lesser included offenses under murder, both manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide, that both required the jury to find that the appellant caused the death of Ms. Moussa. And when we're looking at the totality of the record and everything, it is highly unlikely that the jury would go through murder, read through the other lessors, and recognize that the lessors required the appellant to cause the death of the individual and not make that same finding in the first for murder. And I think with that, it's important to point out what is this harm. We talked about, my opposing counsel talked about the issue of intent was very hotly contested at trial, which it was. I don't disagree with that. But the missing element was caused the death of Ms. Moussa. That is what we are looking at when we're looking at an egregious harm standard, whether the appellant was actually harmed by its omission from the charge. So whether or not the jury, based on all of the evidence they presented, the arguments of counsel, what they knew, would have found him guilty without that finding. So whether it's likely or not the jury convicted him of murder without finding that he caused Ms. Moussa's death.
I have a clarifying question here. So, and I may have understood you wrong. Are you saying that the jury could find an individual guilty of lessors that are contained in the charge that were never indicted in the first place?
Correct. A jury charge, a jury charge can include lesser included offenses that are lessors of the charged offense.
Right. I'm tracking.
Okay.
And in this case, you're saying that you think that that's a possibility of what might have taken place.
Well, in this case, the jury charge included the two lesser included, manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide. The charge conference is not on the record, but the proposed charge was accepted by both the state and defense without any objection, and the court's ultimate charge that was submitted to the jury included those two lesser included offenses, both which would have required the jury to find that the appellant caused Ms. Moussa's death, and they chose not to convict on the lesser included offenses. They convicted on murder.
Basically, your argument is even though the application paragraph specifically instructed the jury to find him guilty of murder without causing her death, because the other alternative and the two lesser included, all three had caused her death as part of the elements of those causes of action, that we are reasonable in inferring that the jury inferred the cause of death element in their finding.
Yes, that the charge as a whole goes towards that analysis, as well as the state of the evidence.
That's also why Flores is distinguished, because there was a straight up either or error in Flores, whereas here, no, we've got 3 out of 4.
Yes. Yes, that's correct, as well as the state of the evidence, which demonstrated that the appellant was alone with Ms. Musa when she died. Dr. Freeze testified that she died by asphyxiation at the hands of another, and that her heart condition did not cause her death, that the evidence in this case supports that that the appellant's actions caused her death, as well as the arguments of both the state and the defense throughout trial. During closing arguments, the state specifically addressed the causation element and made clear that
nobody ever argued that you can convict him of murder without finding that he caused her death.
That is correct. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. All the way back through to voir dire, both parties very clearly laid out the elements of the offense, and it was made known to the jury from that point forward. So it is reasonable to make that ultimate conclusion that they did make that finding, even given the omitted error in the jury charge. Jumping to the indictment and what was authorized or not authorized, whether this even should have been in the jury charge, the state recognizes that this is a jury charge issue, but we cannot look at this first point of error jury charge issue without questioning what was authorized in the indictment, what notice the defendant had, what offenses were contained in the indictment, and kind of going back to the very basics of what an indictment is, counts in an indictment allege separate offenses. Paragraphs in an indictment allege separate means of committing that one offense. The indictment in this case was a one-count indictment for murder, with two paragraphs alleging two separate means of committing that one offense. It was not a two-count indictment with two counts of murder, that one may have been skewed one way or the other. It was one count with these two paragraphs. And looking at the language of the second paragraph, it contained language specific to murder under Penal Code Section 1902b2, in that it alleged that the appellant intended to cause serious bodily injury, as opposed to cause serious bodily injury, which would be what aggravated assault may charge. It also includes the language from 1902b2 that the defendant commits an act clearly dangerous to human life. That specific phrase is very unique to murder as defined by 1902b2. The indictment as a whole, just the face of it, there was no other offense charged. Those were the two, manner and means. So although that indictment second paragraph was missing the cause of death element, from the face of the indictment, it was clear what two manners of murder were being alleged, and therefore that was the law of the case, and the judge and were authorized to submit that both of those manner and means in the jury charge. The omitted element, case law is clear from Studer through Kirkpatrick, and most recently 2021 in Doe v. State, that a missing element in the indictment does not prevent that offense from being submitted to the jury. And Justice Walker, to address kind of your variance question, the trial court has an independent duty to submit the law applicable to the case, a correct charge to the case. So although because the indictment in this case correctly provided the notice of murder and those two manner of means of committing murder, the trial court actually had a duty to submit both of those manner and means in the jury charge. Now, it was supposed to be the correct application, even notwithstanding the omitted element in the indictment. However, that he still had the duty, it was required to be in there because it was part of the indictment, it was part of the law applicable to the case, and authorized by the indictment.
Yeah, in a perfect world, you would have had the appropriate language in the indictment.
Yes.
And the appropriate language would have been in the charge.
Yes.
But in essence, it sounds like what you're saying, as far as the indictment is concerned and the case law that you're citing, is if it gives adequate notice and that the four corners and everything that's contained in the four corners should have given defense counsel adequate notice that this was simply a manner and means variation of murder.
Yes, and not just should have, but from the record, it's clear that it did. During voir dire, both parties questioned or discussed murder under both manner and means before the panel. The defendant was arraigned outside the presence of the jury, before the presence of the jury, with the indictment as it is being read. The defense counsel was very prepared at trial to contest both of these issues, focusing their defense on the intent of the defendant and whether he intended to cause death or intended to cause harm. So not just that the defendant should have had notice, he really did have notice, and the record demonstrates that.
One question, let's switch to the evidentiary.
Yes.
Real quick, and it's the Verny Smith hearsay.
Okay.
I'm troubled by the colloquy between the court and counsel where he initially sustains the hearsay, and then he specifically tells the state to re-ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same objection, overrules it, and then the testimony comes in about he told me he killed his wife, period.
Okay.
And counsel doesn't actually bring this up, but what troubles me about this is this looks like an endorsement by the trial court of that testimony, that the court knew that testimony was coming, changed his mind about the objection, and instead of simply saying, you know what, I'm gonna change my ruling with regard to that question, you may ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
He literally says, re-ask your question, overrules the objection, and that testimony comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to remember here because there were some concessions with regard to error, and I think this is one that the state conceded it was error for that to come in.
Yes.
But why should that not be considered by us with regard to the harm analysis with regard to the admission of that testimony?
Mm-hmm. I think to your point that the specific comment on the weight of the evidence issue was not preserved. So if that's a concern, that would be an unpreserved issue at the trial court. Additionally, I think because Ms. Smith's testimony explicitly contradicting, or maybe not explicitly, but impliedly contradicting the statement attributed to her through Ms. Hastings, the overall harm analysis should really focus on that and the fact that the jury had before it both the testimony of Ms. Hastings and Ms. Smith, and because Ms. Smith's testimony, it wasn't just testified to one time, she repeated throughout her testimony, I think it was three, maybe four times, what she said, or what the appellant told her, what she then told 911, and then what she told the police, so maybe three times.
But you're basically saying that is effectively a comment on the weight objection that should have been made at the time, and therefore we can't consider that as part of the harm analysis.
If that's the court's concern, then that should have been raised at the trial court, and it would be unpreserved at this time. Unless the court has any other specific questions regarding the other points of error, I will rest on my brief for the remaining points and give some time back to the court, and the state would ask the court to overrule appellant's points of error and affirm his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, just a brief rebuttal. With respect to the cumulative error issue, I concede and did in the reply brief that normally new issues are not permitted on a reply brief, and acknowledge that the law states that a cumulative error point of error is an independent legal issue. However, I think in this case, it is directly responsive to the state's brief because the majority of the state's brief centers on harm. And so in responding to the harm, the response to that is that the harm here is cumulative. As stated in the reply brief, each point of error, I believe, are reversible and harmful on their own. But if the court were to agree with the state's brief in its entirety, that each of those things, the conceded errors, if they are errors, and if they are harmless individually, I believe the response to that is to ask the court to look at the cumulative error of the harm. This isn't a new issue out of left field that couldn't have possibly been anticipated. It was submitted directly in response to the state's brief. Also, the counsel has said that because the lesser included portions of the charge did all each include, you know, cause the death of Wissam Musa, that there's no way that a jury could have disregarded that and looking at the error that we have in this charge. I would argue that the way that that works is the jury goes through, starts with murder, and if they find a defendant guilty on murder, they don't go on to the next portions of the charge. The charge in its entirety is read to them, of course, before they go back and deliberate. But as they're back there deliberating and discussing the evidence, they don't go on then to the next portions. So they're only looking at the application paragraph for murder. And once they made that guilty finding, they didn't go on to the next part. Also, while intent was hotly contested, which matters, which between the manner and means, cause of death was also hotly contested, which is why points of error 8, 9, and 10 are really important as well. Because Mr. Al-Khayali's defense was that even if his actions caused harm to her, she had a congenital heart defect, and she had had recent heart problems, and then that there's no way that the state could prove that her existing heart conditions didn't contribute to that. And we've discussed that pretty thoroughly in the brief, and so...
Yeah, I thought that the autopsy report indicated that any heart issues didn't contribute to her death.
The autopsy report did, but because the expert who wrote the autopsy report wasn't the person who testified, when Dr. Fries was testifying to that was hearsay, that was in violation of his confrontation rights. There was no way for him to, for Mr. Al-Khayali to cross-examine that finding, because the person who made that finding wasn't there.
Was there any cross-examination about the fact that she had fainted after her anomaly had been corrected?
There was some...
And whether or not that fainting had been attributed by any medical authority to her cardiac situation as opposed to something else?
I believe that there was some... defense counsel did cross-examine the forensic expert about that. According to the forensic expert's reliance on these hearsay documents, he found that that wasn't the case. And I believe that Mr. Al-Khayali himself testified that after their wedding, she had gone to the hospital and was told that she was having chest pains and shortness of breath, and was told to be admitted and to have that reviewed, and she refused. She refused to be there. Defense also sought to introduce those medical records from Jordan, and the trial court disallowed that those records should be admitted. But the testimony about their contents was admitted through Mr. Al-Khayali's testimony.
Cross-examination of the expert.
So that's specifically cause of death is why that expert opinion, that expert testimony is so important. And the confrontation violation matters in this case because he was permitted to say this doctor found that she didn't have any problems in 2018 when he had not himself made those findings. There was no way to cross-examine that. And before my time runs out, if I could just respond, Justice Birdwell, to your last question about Ms. Smith. Ms. Smith did not contradict that testimony, by the way. The state has indicated that her testimony fixed the error because she said, oh, no, he didn't say that to me. She did not. Her testimony did not say that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Your case is submitted. We appreciate the argument. It's been very helpful. And we're going to take about a five-minute recess before our second oral argument.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeals is now in recess. You're dismissed.
Thanks. Oh, no, you're talking. Didn't we eat it?